Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Thank you for coming along tonight. My name is Stuart MacDonald. I'm the Green candidate here in Witney. This is one of our Green public meetings. We have a whole series of these throughout the year, but this gets a bit more intensive towards election time. Why do we have them? Well, I think the main reason is to show that we're not as odd as many people think. We're not all tree huggers. In fact, very few of us are tree huggers. We're concerned with a whole range of social and economic issues that are of importance to the community as a whole. One of these is housing. It is of major importance nationally, and is of particular importance in Oxfordshire. So, we are extremely fortunate to have Danny Dorling with us tonight, who is the world expert on housing in Oxfordshire. He's going to talk to us about inequality and housing in Oxfordshire. You'll have noticed that there's filming going on. It's of Danny Dorling, not me. At questions, which I will have at the end, one or two of you may be filmed. If you object to being filmed, just say so at the time, otherwise we'll assume you don't have any objections to it. So, thank you very much, Danny.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for coming. I've just got about a dozen slides to show you. I'll just tell you a little story about housing. I should start off by saying I'm not the world expert on housing in Oxfordshire. I left Oxfordshire 26, 27 years ago, and I came back last year. I have written a book a year ago on housing. I could tell you a lot about Sheffield and housing. But I can tell you acutely what it's like to try to move a family and house them in Oxford, which even though I spent a lot of time looking at housing and housing prices and so on, I didn't realise how difficult that would be, and I know this county and this city, which is probably the only reason I'm actually here, because if I was a normal new hire at Oxford University, I'd probably be looking to leave right now, because I wouldn't have managed to have housed myself. Stuart asked me to produce some stats for you at the beginning, so I produced these things of the average house, and of course there isn't an average house, but the Zoopla average house in Witney rose by £37,000 last year to hit the heady heights of £348,000. I checked it this morning, and of course these things are based on very low numbers, this morning it was £418,000. You will never again in your lives ever have anybody tell you that the house price has risen by the equivalent of £70,000 in such a short amount of time. It isn't just a blip. What's happened is that the maximum London rise, which was about 12, 18 months ago, when London was going full pelt at 20, 21, 22% rises per annum, that London rise has rippled out from London. It rippled through Oxford, just as I was trying to buy a house in Oxford. People sort of said, no, that can't be right. That's 100,000, 200,000 more than it should have been, or more than it was 2 years ago. And that house price ripple from London is now moving through West Oxfordshire. Now, right in the very heart of London, house prices have gone down ever so slightly in the last couple of months. So your Chancellor, whose main job, you may not have noticed this, since becoming Chancellor in 2010, his main job has been to hold up house prices. He has spent more taxpayers' money on holding up house prices than on anything else. He did a whole series of policies, of which by far the biggest was Help to Buy. Help to Buy was committing up to £130 billion of taxpayers' money to guarantee mortgages so that banks and building societies would lend, will lend, to people that they otherwise would not choose to lend to because the risk is too great. Help to Buy itself wasn't enough, so he changed the rules. He changed the rules, I think, on stamp duty. He's changed the rules very recently allowing people to buy with their annuities in a few weeks' time. And he changed the rules at the last budget to give people mini housing ISAs. So for the youngsters in the room, if you're very well behaved and you save £100, £200, George Osborne will chip in another £50 towards your deposit on buying a house, at the same time as the houses are going up in value by £70,000. I can't work out, I honestly can't work out the extent to which George Osborne doesn't understand what he's doing, or is very clever and does understand what he's doing with all of this. But housing has never been this unaffordable here. And it's possible for it not to correct. This is the only complicated slide I've got. So please please bear with me for this one. This is a slide that says it's possible this may carry on. Not at this current rate, not at the equivalent of £70,000 rises in just a few months, but long term. What this slide is showing you is data from the British Social Attitude Survey. Every year from 1983 to 2012, running up and down at ages, people at the top are aged 18, people at the bottom are aged 90. The red coloured cells are people who are renting. So in that year of that age, most people in England, especially in Britain, this is British data, are renting. The green coloured cells are where the majority of people either own their house or are buying with a mortgage. Now you'll see that in the 80s, for elderly people, the majority were renting. That was the end of the mass council house era, the very end of a few people who were private renting. If we went back 90 years, 100 years ago, most people rented privately. That cohort was largely disappearing and was being replaced by it becoming normal for the middle family. You got a mortgage and you bought your house. Now if you look right at 2012 at the edge, you'll see that the red is coming down again. What we're getting is a return to the majority of people in their 30s and early 40s renting again. The middle person renting. The big difference is that the middle person now in Britain is a university graduate. That green diagonal slice is one wide generation of home ownership. And if current trends continue, then you're looking at the future where again the majority of people will rent, and again they'll rent from private landlords. Already more people are renting from private landlords than are renting from housing associations or councils. A small number of pretty well-off people like me will be able to get a mortgage, and there'll be an even smaller number, maybe 2, 3, 4%, who will own properties, multiple properties, often renting them out. We're already very quickly on the road to this, and I think this is cock-up. Because if you were planning to have this transformation back to the 1920s and 30s, you'd have done it a bit more subtly and a bit more slowly. What happened was, when the housing market crashed for 2008, the number of transactions on the market halved across the country. People simply couldn't get mortgages, they couldn't move by selling or buying a house. So what they did is they rented. You had to rent if you were going to move, and investors began to buy at slightly lower rates. The investors found that they could charge higher and higher rents. And with the rents that they were getting, they're able to buy another house, another house, and another house. As they bought, so it's landlords mainly buying now in Oxford, as the investors bought, they pushed the house prices up, making it even harder for people to buy, so more people come to rent, so the rents can come up. By last year, the commission, the government's Commission for Social Mobility and Child Poverty, had discovered that a quarter of all families in England with children were in private renting. We had a small private rented, or we had a small private rented sector. We acknowledged it was too small, we wanted it to get bigger, particularly bigger for students and young people and young professionals so they could move around the country. There was never any intention for this private rented sector to become the sector you'd go into when you had a baby. That wasn't the aim. Wasn't the stated aim of the policy. The problem with the private rented sector for families is that you can be moved on with just 2 months' notice. And if you have children, children tend to get friends. They tend to really dislike losing their friends. If the landlord puts up the rent and you can't pay it, you have to find somewhere else you can afford, which means moving school and losing all your friends. In recent years in London, the rate at which that's been happening is on average between 12 and 18 months that these families have been moved on. They're moved on because they cannot outcompete young couples without children. Because young couples without children can pay a little bit more rent because they've got less expenses. So the rents are going up, everybody's shuffling around, people are being moved, and they really don't like moving. The landlords justify putting up the rents up because they look at the value of the property and the size of their mortgages, because lots of them are borrowing to do this, and they say a fair rent is a much higher rent. That could carry on. It is the current direction of travel. Help to Buy ISAs are going to not dent it one iota. Maybe in the very poorest part of Blackpool they will have an effect. But even there, there's actually a market for buying property and renting it out to people who turn up in Blackpool. So we're heading back to a kind of forelock tugging past. You know, be grateful that the landlord lets you live in the property that you're in. So if you sort of say this has to stop, nobody can afford to buy these properties in Whitley and in this part of Oxfordshire. There are people who can afford to buy them, but the only way you can justify prices at these heights is if the people who are going to live in those houses are going to pay a rent to the point they die. And you're suddenly bringing in more money than you would from a mortgage, which somebody might pay after 25 years. I really don't think this was the plan. I don't think anybody met on a yacht and said, look, we can do this, we can get rich. If you remember that the ethos of the Conservative Party in the 1980s was a home-owning democracy. The Conservative Party, particularly Margaret Thatcher, became convinced that council houses turned people red, and you had to give people the right to buy, and you wanted everybody to have a stake, and then you could have a Conservative country forever. I don't think the Conservative Party has changed its beliefs that much. I don't think it's a plan that this is the direction in which we're heading so rapidly, but it is the direction in which we're currently going. And as we head through there, that green generation, the ones who bought, are going to do well, temporarily, in what might look for them to be a big way, but is actually quite a small way. The majority of people who own a house in West Oxfordshire, or have got a mortgage and most of it's paid off, are looking at cashing in. So you don't hear people protesting when house prices appear to increase by 70,000 for the average property in and around the constituency. You don't get mass house of protest. You get people going, oh, look at that. I'm going to enjoy my retirement. That's another couple of cruises. And I can bung some money to the grandkids, and that'll help them. I can give them £10,000, £20,000. Some of money you couldn't have believed being given yourself when you were young. And you think, oh, that'll help, that'll sort them out. But it won't. Unless there are four grandparents going down to two children, going down to one grandchild. In which case, yes, a lot of money will funnel down to them. If you don't go on the cruises, that is. Unless that's the situation you're in, if there's the same number of you, you can't protect your family through inheritance. But the protecting through inheritance mechanism has become one of the main ways that people try to sort this out. The majority of people now are buying with quite a large deposit. In almost all cases, those deposits are not saved, they are gifts from family. What you're getting are mini welfare states. Welfare states are grandparents, uncles and aunts, mums and dads, looking after each other to try to help the next generation just be able to house themselves. One big problem of that, and it exacerbates the landlord problem, is that to do that, if you are sitting in a large property here, maybe a property that's a bit too large for you and it costs a bit too much to heat, in the interest of your family, it's worth you hanging on for longer in that property as it goes up in value, because you can give them more later. When everybody starts doing that, you end up with lots and lots of underused property. And I haven't got another graph that shows you this, but we've looked back at every census back to 1911, and we have never had so much underused property. This is property with one person in it, maybe two, with five rooms, six rooms, seven rooms. So at the same time as one group of people are really crowding themselves in the middle of Oxford, the middle of London, another group of people are pretty spread out. And that is exacerbating the housing shortage. The other one, which is a really good news one, is that we're living longer. But our housing system was designed for us to live to about 70, 75. We haven't built large numbers of very decent flat retirement apartments to decant yourself to when you want to. There are lots of things we could do, but there's no individual incentive to do them. Over things that are being done, I mean, I think Whitney's problem and West Oxfordshire's problem is Oxford, and I think Oxford's problem is London. If you sort out London, a lot of Oxford's problem reduces, and that should reduce problems out here, because you won't get people living here who'd much rather be living in Oxford and don't want to be sitting on the A40 in the morning, but have to. This is Barton West. This is the major development that's happening fairly soon. It's, if you know Barton, it's just the west of Barton, just the north of the Ring Road. It's a lot of houses, about 800 odd houses. It's a really interesting question about where the secondary school is going to be. Since all the secondaries have become academies, nobody's responsible for that kind of issue anymore. The thing that annoys me is that nobody seems responsible for the fact that all these children are going to have to cross the Ring Road to go to school. But I'm going to spend the next 3 years going on about that until somebody builds a bridge. But that's what's being done, and it's pretty tiny. The other one is extensions up at Water Eaton, round about Kidlington. I've crossed out that you have to worry about prisons, because things do happen. You may know there's been a campaign against the detention centre in Campsfield, I think for 25 years now. I think my mum was part of the beginning of it when she was here. And it's half won. Campsfield is not to be doubled in size to become Europe's largest detention centre. It's going to stay its same size, and its future's going to be reviewed. So we might actually get Campsfield going, because you really can't use, apart from any other objections you might have to detaining people who actually haven't broken the law, using land just north of Oxford for a prison isn't necessarily great. But that's part of the flood maps of what's... Oxford, apart from West Barton, which at least is slightly high, the new housing is north near the river and south, not that far from the river. For some reason, I'm beginning to work out what it is, but for some reason, east and west off the floodplain isn't allowed. North and south extension is allowed. I'm sceptical, you can tell from my tone of voice about all of this, because I've just spent 28 years moving around the country. Places like 10 years in Newcastle, 10 years in Sheffield I've lived, where they've been building houses. And I come back down to Oxford and come and look at the map and find that they've been building hardly any at all. A little extension to Blackbird Leeds, a tiny little bit in Risinghurst, but nothing at all. In general, I've written a book called All That Is Solid About Housing. I wrote most of it in Sheffield. A lot of what the book says is that we don't need huge amounts of building. We need to use our existing stock a lot better, and certainly stop using it worse and worse and worse. But our population is going up. We are lucky to have our population going up. You can't have a population going up without having a plan about how to house these extra people, and you need to look at where they're really wanting to live. And where the bulk of them want to live and be is London, and after London, the kind of place they want to be is Oxford. All industries in Oxford are growing, not just the education, the two universities and the schools, the hospitals. And the hospitals are looking at substantial growth to come because it's an ageing population. And then you can look at the publishing industry in Oxford, you can even look at the car industry. The high-end car industry is growing. Or if you look at BMW, it's 1% of all our manufacturing exports from the country come from Cowley. Just 3,000 people working there. It's the most economically successful city you'll next to in the country. It's a kind of economic dream when you look at what it is across Spain. It's also, Oxford is now over a quarter overseas born and accelerating. It's the most cosmopolitan city in the country. Maybe not quite as much as London, but it's cosmopolitan. I'll just do one little survey here because I do this in Oxford all the time. Can you put up your hand if you were born in this constituency in West Oxfordshire? Let's get an idea. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's good. That's actually the highest I've had in a year and a half of giving public talks in many different parts around the city. This is a migrant place. Almost everybody is a migrant. The reason for putting Carfax up there is that if you are thinking about trying to sort out housing and to produce some more houses, you've got to worry about transport. The roads are full. The roads really are full. We can talk about building new roads and the problems about building new roads, but they are full. Somebody suggested in the 1960s that all the roads from Carfax should be made one way outwards, which would work. But if Oxford is going to take more people who want to be in Oxford, so that the 40,000 people who drive to the park and rides on the edge of Oxford every day don't have to drive to the park and rides, it will have to sort its transport system out as well. Whenever you're talking about housing, you're talking about housing and transport. The current policy in the county is largely to expand villages, 100 houses on the edge of this village, 100 houses on the edge of that village, causing enormous upset and generating incredible amounts of political activity. You've never seen the amount of effort that people will go to. The signs they're put up on the edge of the village saying no more houses here. And if only you could galvanise all that political energy and just ask the people who say no houses here to also campaign for where they want the houses to be, yeah, it would be useful. So Oxfordshire's plan is expand the villages and expand the county towns and have two garages or two parking spaces of each one, and don't worry about the A40 and the A34, somehow they'll all be okay. This slide is old. This is in the centre of cities, and the crucial column is the first one. I mean, old, it's less than a year old. A year ago, the centre of cities worked out that the average Oxford house price was 14.9 times the average Oxford income. It's now 16.1. When I arrived in the city 18 months ago, it was 9-1. Can you imagine trying to buy a house while that's going on? It's higher than London because London gets London-weighted salaries, whereas Oxford doesn't. But Oxford salaries are higher than salaries out in West Oxfordshire, on average. And it can fool you, that kind of ratio can fool you. You can say, oh, it's a few houses in North Oxford dragging it up. But the city have produced a map for the whole city, just showing you how little more's unaffordable. Barton's unaffordable. Now, bits of Blackford Leeds aren't yet, but give it another 6 months. And that's where we're heading. Green belts. Green belts are fairly key. Green belts, and it's the Green Party, because I think the Green Party really ought to take on green belts. But they are the party most qualified to say what to do about green belts. Green belts were a brilliant thing when they were introduced, but they were introduced at a time when we didn't understand things like flooding. The flooding actually means there's more areas that are naturally green than we had thought. And the green belts are now not particularly green because they're forcing very large numbers of people to commute over the green belts. 5,000 people at the moment from Oxford to London are going across that green belt every day. The majority, I think, by bus and car, which is a lot of emissions. This is before we do that really clever thing in a few months' time have opened that second station up at Watereton. This is going to be really good for Whitney, because you can get to that second station. You might have to sort of crawl for half an hour through the traffic jam. But you can buy a house here, nice house out in the countryside, get in your car, drive to the big car park at Watereton, get in your train, 1 hour direct to Marylebone. And then you can walk 100 yards to your office in Harley Street, because that's where Marylebone Station is. It isn't any old London station that we've connected ourselves to. That is about the hitters. Part of the reason for the prices rising up at the top and around here is that people have realised that that's hitters, so we're going to have many more people going across to London. At the same time, London prices have just done the most amazing thing. It is hard to find houses in the worst streets in Barking and Dagenham that are less expensive than in Oxford. So, you're a young publisher. You work, I don't know, in any job that doesn't require you to be there at 7 in the morning or 8 in the morning. Where do you want to live? Do you want to live in Barking and Dagenham or do you want to live in Oxford? So it's getting a very, very rapid increase in people from London beginning to come here. That's one problem with the Greenbelt, with London Greenbelt. Oxford Greenbelt, much bigger problem. Not 5,000 people, 40,000 people. People living in Birmingham coming in now. Routinely, it being normal to do this. Head teachers living in Birmingham at secondary schools. The difference between a normal teacher and a head teacher in Oxford is that the head teacher can buy a house 30 minutes out of the city. A normal teacher can only rent. But that's the difference. You look around Oxford schools now, all kinds of schools, private schools, state schools, and if you're my age, if you want to feel really, really old, you can, because the teachers are in their 20s. And for a large number of them, after 3, 4, 5 years, they get absolutely sick of losing all their salary on rent, because you can be a teacher anywhere in the country. So the latest anecdote I heard from the head of the City Council was that of the last 11 heads that they were trying to appoint for primary schools, they could only get 2 external candidates appointed, because people will not come to run. Now we're lucky, we've still got a cohort of internal teachers you can promote upwards. Other things change, and some things change for the good when it becomes this expensive. So in Matthew Arnold School, nearest school to here, well, it's not in Oxford, but practically, the cleaning is now done by the sixth form students. Because, well, how are you going to get people to clean? So it's interesting. Academically, Oxford and Oxfordshire is a kind of sentinel place to tell the rest of the country what it's going to be like in future for them. If you're trying to look ahead at what's going to happen as house prices stay high, continue high, and the gap between wages and house prices move apart like this, you need to look at here to tell people in neighbouring counties and then further afield what they're going to get. So the main point of putting this up was the Centre of Cities report was sponsored by Barrett's. A whole lot of people have got their eyes on this. And I have a lot of worry. I'm not too worried that things won't happen. I think things are going to happen. I have a huge amount of worry that things will happen without enough scrutiny very, very quickly. And some people may become very wealthy very fast. And we may not get something that's for the general good as a result of this. Going back to Oxford, we're trying to say that Oxford is part of the solution to your problems. That's a 3 and a 5 mile ring. These are distances which are cyclable from Carfax. I'm not suggesting we build over Whiteham Woods or anywhere, but it's a very, very, very constrained city. There's the mix of jobs. It is not just education. You'll see in Headington far more people in health and social work than in education. You'll see the manufacturing in Cowley. See the large other sections. There's lots and lots going on, lots of people, lots of opportunities. You could try and reduce the opportunities. I mean, you could say, let's make Oxford be a bit more like Windsor with the castle and that school where they wear those frock coats. And in a way, we almost are a bit like Windsor. We've got old buildings and we've got people wearing funny clothes for the tourists to take photographs of, including me. I get to wear these sometimes. But I don't think fossilising it is a particularly good option, but it's an option. Other options. There's two maps here, getting towards the end of this. My favourite map is that circular map. That circular map is a 1927 plan for the city of Oxford. It's the old and ancient plan for the city of Oxford. It's circular because back in 1927, the modal form of transport was walking or cycling. In fact, that was the modal form of transport when I was growing up in Oxford in the 1970s and early 80s. I had to wait for the men who were cycling four abreast at the car plant to stop before I could actually cross the road. This has been a cycling city for a long time. Now the people cycling are generally richer. The same thing is happening in London, but Oxford's a cycling city. So that was the 1927 plan. You'll see the plan was for a larger city than the city we've got. The plan got some things wrong. Those green areas are what they thought the extent of the floodplain was. You'll see they were slightly over-enthusiastic. The floodplain is wider than that. They were going to put a major arterial road right through the middle of Old Marston, many of you know it well, which didn't happen. But the plan was to have housing out to east and west, off the floodplain, on the hill, where there's currently a golf course. Actually, in the parts of Oxford, you actually get to see the spires from. And that's where I would put very beautifully designed apartments, particularly for elderly people who don't want to be in large houses in Summertown anymore. Because if you can create housing for older people that suits them more and they can choose to go to, they free up large family homes that the family can move into, who then free up the home that they're squeezing into, who then free up a home that somebody else can go into. And you solve many people's housing problems at once. But you can't do it without a bit more housing in Oxford. The arrows there is my suggestion about which way the one-way system of Oxford should go in the future. This might sound fanciful. The Banbury and Oxford Road are the easiest ones. But I come back to the city. It's the city I left when the buses were fighting each other at Cornmarket, when we had complete deregulation. I think I can remember the cars there. I come back and find they've pedestrianised Cornmarket. I come back and find that they've put all these cycle lanes on pavements. Things do change. It's just the only way you can see change is to leave the city for 28 years and come back again. The Cowley Road is now chicane. The whole city is 20 miles an hour. I mean, lots of good stuff has happened. But if you are going to have more people in Oxford, you're going to have to improve the transport. And the only way to improve the transport is to create more space for bikes. And that probably means reducing the lanes down to one for cars and buses. Which will really cause annoyance in some areas. That's just zooming in to show you how long they got the plans in 1927. And it's partly to show you don't hold the green belt quite so sacrosanct. It was the same thinking for the green belt that thought that that's how the Charwell flooded and how the Thames flooded. The fact that these rivers flood, and the floods are getting worse, and the floods are going to get worse still, tells us that we're going to have a lot of very protected land in the middle of these cities. That's the commuting numbers, if you just want to see them, but they are large. They tell you how many people are driving, mainly to the edge. Cycling and walking. In the Netherlands, half the population cycle and walk to work. In most of mainland Europe, it's higher, we are lower. Oxford, Cambridge and Hull have the highest proportions at the moment, but they're pretty low, I don't know, about 12%, that kind of number, as opposed to 50%. In the United States, only 3.5% of people cycle and walk to work. And there's a beautiful correlation between the proportion of people who cycle and walk to work and obesity. And it makes a lot of sense if you think about it. Sitting in a car is one of the best ways not to do any exercise at all. The one way you can decrease the amount of exercise is to invent driverless cars, because then you aren't even using your foot on the pedal. And amazingly, driverless cars are being put forward as an apparent solution, mainly from California, because they've got these really high obesity rates. The figures up there are the proportion of journeys made by people aged 65 and over by bike. So in the UK it's 1%. My standard thing to say is I think most of the 1% is in Oxford for people over 65 cycling, but it's just 1% of journeys made by people over 65 are cycling. In Germany it's 9%, in Denmark it's 15%, and in the Netherlands a quarter of all journeys made by pensioners are done on their bike. If you're wanting a kind of city to begin to do this in, it won't take much for Oxford to beat Hull and Cambridge and actually have the highest proportion cycling in the country. And it's green. It's very green to be doing this. It is not green to be driving to a park and ride, having queued up, and you've still got to get into the city to work. Then you work for an employer who doesn't pay you enough, and you get all the way out to the park and ride, you get in your car, and you get all the way home over the green belt to wherever you've managed to buy, having inflated the cost of the housing in the place you've managed to buy. That's where I grew up, so I just thought I'd put a picture of the roads. The roads came before the cars. Cars are a recent thing. If you're talking about an historic county, an historic city, cars really are a pretty recent thing. I'm not completely against cars. I have a car. You know, occasionally I have to use it. I'm lucky that I don't have to use it most days. But any expansion that relies on cars is going to cause trouble. And if you believe that more roads are the solution, the best place to try to build a road, if you want to maximise road protests, is Oxfordshire. Because then the road protesters don't have to travel all the way down to Newbury or wherever. They can just go back to mum and dad's house in Oxford for the night if it gets a bit cold. And it's road protesters that have stopped quite a lot of road schemes because they're now putting the cost-benefit calculations for them. Okay, tiny bit on politics. Let's get into it very near the end. This is the index of multiple deprivation. This is a map of it. The red areas are the poor areas, apart from Merton and Oriel College, where the statistician simply got it wrong in the centre of Oxford. But the red areas are the poor areas, the green areas are better off. You can see your four wards in the middle of Whitney, which are a bit more normal, which gets very annoyed when everybody says how affluent Whitney is. But there's still nothing like the areas in Oxford. And the dark green is most affluent 10th of the population. And if you're trying to predict politics, these are the things that really predict voting. The only reason that Oxford East is Labour is the red areas. Bit of tradition and other things, but it's the red areas. Oxford West is marginal, liberal, conservative, because it's not quite dark green enough not to be. And over here, somebody very rudely put it, you could dress up a monkey in a blue suit and they'd be voted for. And it's the dark green. It's the dark green that causes that. Coming to conclusion. This part of the county needs Oxford's housing to be sorted out. Sorting out Oxford is your main problem. There's loads of things you can then do which will be very, very good, but if you don't sort out Oxford, none of them are going to work because people will live here who have to be in Oxford. There's a lot Oxford could do. Oxford is too small. We shouldn't have a golf course 2 miles from Carfax with just a few people seeing those views. But even if Oxford were to do the most brilliant schemes that were beautifully, you know, arts and craft houses that were the nicest thing, none of it's going to work unless London is sorted out. Because it'll just become a beautiful kind of Hampstead Garden suburb of London if we sort out Oxford without London being sorted out. So we need London to sort itself out. London's beginning to plan how to sort itself out. London has the most active political groups on housing in the country. And they're not left-wing. It's really fascinating. And the reason they're not left-wing is because of who gets to be in London. You only get to move into London if you're highly successful. You're a university graduate. You've done very well from a particularly good university. You get yourself a job in London. You manage to survive the job in London because they sack people very frequently. You get promoted. Eventually you get to 41. And most of your colleagues have actually left and given up. If you look at London, the average age is 33. You've got to 41. It's all about you. It's all individualistic. You've probably voted Conservative all your life since you're 18. And then you find you cannot buy a house at 41. Well, maybe you just could by mortgaging yourself to the hilt. And if interest rates rise by 0.5%, you've had it. Or if house prices fall, because you're the fool who actually buys at the peak, you've had it. And what's fascinating in London is that, and I'm stereotyping them a bit much, but if that happens, you then get priced out created, you get generation rent created, you get the intergenerational foundation created, you get all these lobby groups in London who say something has to be done. Because you cannot damage the life chances of the upper middle class and get away with it in Britain. That's when you get real change. I'd argue we got an NHS because the country became too poor to afford private doctors and it was the interest of the upper middle class to have an NHS. I can go on with this theory, but the upper middle class are politically powerful. You can't just run a society in the interest of a tiny aristocracy. And the upper middle class in London are highly angry about the situation that they're finding themselves in. The kindest thing that's been suggested is to change the London council tax system. Well, for a start, revalue it. Don't use 1992 valuations, actually use current valuations. Have council tax is the same across the whole of London. Have the bands simply going up so that somebody whose house is worth 2 million pays twice as much as somebody whose house is worth 1 million, but don't complain too much about it because they're paying half as much as somebody whose house is worth 4 million, who's paying half as much as somebody whose house is worth 8 million. And we've got houses going for 60 million. London will argue to ring fence that money. That's an enormous amount of money. They do it in New York, so this is not revolutionary. That amount of money would allow London to do incredible things, including build a lot of houses, but it could actually pay for Crossrail 3 and 4 by itself. It could become its own mini state, but it could in theory sort itself out. If London could sort itself out, other things become possible, and that is being discussed about, but it's, we can't just hope for that. And to end, I decided to pull down one of the flood maps for here, but I won't say anything else, but we do have to worry about flooding. We do need to be moving slightly away from the flood areas and certainly not building on them. The floods are getting worse, the standing rain is getting worse. Even if you divert the flood water and build relief rivers and so on, all you're going to do is cause Abingdon a hell of a problem. And if Abingdon sorts itself out, you're going to give Reading a hell of a problem. And if Reading sorts itself out, and there's a very high tide in the North Sea, you should see the map of what happens to London. So I won't say any more about flooding, but flooding does matter. I think this really matters to people. It matters to them most at the point where they're trying to house themselves or when they're being moved around. You can become complacent very easily if you've managed to get yourself housed and you sit still. Oxford and West Oxfordshire is only full of winners. People are chucked out if they fail in life because they can't be housed. When I was born in the Jericho area in Oxford, and my mum and dad left it because you couldn't bring up a baby in the red light district in Oxford. So they went upmarket to Cowley. And if you remember what happened to Jericho, it was slum cleared and emptied out, and Oxford upped and tipped its paw over the side of the hill to Barton and Blackbird Leys. Oxfordshire is now tipping its paw out of the county. And politically, this means that you're left only with winners and recent immigrants, which is part of the reason why you don't get a real anger about this. So the anger's often second hand. It's about people's children, it's about their siblings, it's about other people who can't be housed. But this is the major cost for us. The cost of housing, the mortgage, the rent, all the heating bills are the major cost that people have in their lives. If you can get the cost of housing down, it's the equivalent of thousands of trade unions winning slight increases on their pay. I mean, it solves the cost of living crisis for the majority of people. Landlords will not stop doing all the wonderful decorating, all the rest of the stuff that they do for their tenants if the rents go down. Landlords are not going to take a bulldozer to their properties and knock it down. The cost of housing goes down. The number of people who genuinely lose is pretty small from this. But because it's a collective thing, because you can see no way of getting the cost of housing down for yourself, it makes sense instead to put all your energies into stopping somebody building a house next to your house. Because in the short term, that might maximise your ability. And we have to work a way out of this. The last thing, very last thing I'll say, people often say, why isn't housing a larger priority? When you ask people what matters most to them, why isn't it higher? I think it is. I think that when people say, as they've said at every general election apart from 2010, that the biggest political issue for them is immigration, what they're actually talking about is housing and their own standards of living. But they've been taught to blame all of this on other people coming. The only reason immigration wasn't the major issue in 2010 was the largest economic crash that we'd ever measured managed to get the population to just tip the economy over immigration as the thing we worried about most in 2010. And I think housing's there in people's consciousness, but they express it by talking about how terrible immigration is, because they equate that to how expensive it is to live in a country, because they assume it's the people coming in who are making the housing cost so much, whereas it's mainly the way we've come to arrange our housing and how we're housed. Thank you very much.